This third lecture of Unit 7, Component 2, will continue our discussion of quality measurement and improvement. The topics we will cover include the role of information technology and informatics in quality measurement and improvement, some of the results of current approaches that have been taken, and a discussion of the challenges, limitations, and ethical issues related to quality measurement and improvement. What is the role of information technology, or IT, and informatics? Clearly, quality improvement cannot be done without quality measurement, and measurement really cannot be done without the use of electronic systems to capture data. Of course, it goes beyond IT, and informatics can play a role, as demonstrated by some of the programs listed on this slide. FALS recently published a series of case studies that demonstrated the real-world use for quality measurement and improvement. The National Quality Forum, NQF, has been developing structural measures for health IT use. There are 9 measures that include aspects of health IT that are known to improve quality. These include e-prescribing, interoperable electronic health records, care management, and quality registries. NQF has also developed data sets and flows for automated quality measurement. Even more importantly, standards are emerging that will enable more consistent reporting of quality. There is the Quality Reporting Document Architecture, or QRDA, for quality records, and more recently, the Hospital Quality Measures Format, abbreviated by HQMF, and also called e-measures. There is some evidence that electronic health record use is associated with better quality, or at least better quality measures in some settings, in particular inpatient settings. One analysis looked at hospitals in the University Health Consortium, or UAC. This is a consortium of academic teaching hospitals. When they looked at sites that had achieved HIMSS, Healthcare Information and Management Systems Society, Analytics Stage 4 or higher, EHR adoption that includes computerized physician order entry and clinical decision support, those institutions were found to have higher scores on quality measures. Another analysis comes from the magazine Hospitals and Health Networks, which produces an annual report of the 100 most wired hospitals in the United States. They found that those hospitals were more likely to have higher scores on certain quality measures. In outpatient settings, however, it is less clear. For example, in the following 2 studies that looked at whether the presence of electronic health records was correlated with better quality of care, one analysis looked at quality measures for diabetes, and another analysis looked at 17 general ambulatory quality measures. In both instances, whether or not a practice had electronic health record had no bearing on the level of quality provided in the practice. It is clear that better quality is not automatic from an electronic health record, and that substantial effort is required to achieve that quality. That leads us to think about inpatient settings, where the improvement in quality is not due to the presence of computerized physician order entry, or CPOE, or electronic health records, but perhaps those institutions, in addition to pursuing electronic health records and CPOE, also have an overall strategy for process improvement. We need to be careful about attributing too much of quality improvement to the presence of electronic health record system, which is really just a tool to get us there. Whether or not EHRs are associated with improved quality, it is clear that they can augment the data that is used in quality measures. In fact, it is really almost a requirement. There certainly is great value to the coded information that is in an electronic health record. One analysis by Tang and colleagues found that it significantly improved the ability to assess diabetes quality measures. In addition, we know that administrative, sometimes called claims, data alone is insufficient to calculate, for example, HEDIS or healthcare effectiveness data and information set measures. Data from the electronic health record can improve the accuracy of calculating those HEDIS measures, as well as calculating things like disease-specific mortality. However, the existence of an EHR does not necessarily mean there is quality data. A lot of data in the electronic health record is narrative text that is difficult to access and process. It has been shown in heart failure, for example, that there is some important data that becomes inaccessible because it is in clinical notes, yet these are needed to assess quality. One example of this is exclusion data for medications. For example, patients who should be on a beta blocker or angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor or ACE inhibitor. On the other hand, some data can be extracted by natural language processing techniques as effectively as manual abstraction in some areas, although we do not have the general ability to do natural language processing in every area. But in some areas, such as smoking cessation advice, the diabetic foot exam, and congestive heart failure, we can create natural language processing systems that recognize data that can be used to feed quality measures. One challenge of quality measurement is that it requires interaction among a number of different groups that historically have not worked together. For example, 10 or 20 years ago, before the widespread use of IT, the quality measures community was quite distinct from content developers, people who would develop guidelines and quality measures and clinical decision support and also standards organizations. People apply the measures in a standardized way. The new framework, where we require quality experts, informatics experts, content experts, and standards experts, requires collaboration across a number of different groups. Next, we will discuss the results of current approaches to quality measurement, a couple of noteworthy partnerships, and the research to determine if better performance on quality measures, particularly process measures, leads to improved patient outcomes. We will actually see that there is evidence for and against. We will also look at other problems that might arise from the current approaches to measure quality. At a minimum, there are three major approaches being used for quality assessment and acting on that assessment. One is internal feedback, where an organization will measure quality and use that data to get clinicians to change their practices to achieve higher quality. The reporting and incentives are internal. Another approach is public reporting, where a state government, health plan, or health system will report things like cost, mortality, and/or complication rates, and other measures. A few representative examples are listed on this slide. One is the New York Cardiac Surgery Reporting System, which reports mortality for cardiac surgery in the state of New York. States also report information about hospitals. The state of Oregon has a website that reports mortality rates, number of cases, costs, and so forth for the 50 or so hospitals in the state of Oregon. Some organizations take it upon themselves to report their own quality. For example, Oregon Health and Science University has devoted part of its website to being proactive about quality reporting. It lists the measures that are reported to demonstrate that the institution takes quality seriously. The other major approach to quality assessment and action is pay for performance, which is widespread in the United Kingdom, where a significant amount of the salary of a general practitioner is tied into quality measures. In the United States, there is a more piecemeal approach, where some larger health plans employ pay-for-performance as well as health maintenance organizations and a number of programs in the state of Massachusetts. Other noteworthy healthcare quality and improvement programs are the work of the LeapFrog Group, the Bridges to Excellence Program, and the English Quality and Outcomes Framework in England. The LeapFrog Group was established early in this decade by a group of private healthcare purchasers, namely large companies, who wanted to improve the quality of care that they purchase for their employees. They initially came up with three leaps, and in these leaps, they said they would only purchase healthcare from health plans and systems that A. use computerized physician order entry, B. maintained adequate physician staffing in their intensive care units, and C. only performed certain high-risk procedures in high-volume centers. These were the initial three leaps, and there were subsequent leaps, such as the adoption of the 30 safe practices from the National Quality Forum and participation in various hospital quality reporting initiatives. There has been some skepticism, however, of LeapFrog's choices. As we know, there are some mixed results in terms of the value of CPOE. We also discussed in the last lecture high-volume procedures, some of which have been shown to be associated with better quality, but other ones that have not. In addition, there is the notion that the ICU should be staffed by an adequate number of physicians. There is actually not much evidence for this, although it is grounded in common sense. The Bridges to Excellence program is a consortium of various stakeholders, also led by purchasers, that recently published a 5-year summary of their activities. A number of principles guide Bridges to Excellence. It is known, for example, that re-engineering care processes to reduce mistakes requires investments, so purchasers should create incentives for hospitals and practitioners that bear the burden of investment costs. Another principle is that significant reductions in defects of healthcare, as they call it, will reduce waste and inefficiencies in the healthcare system. Another principle is that the release of comparative provider performance data delivered to consumers in a compelling way will increase accountability and quality improvements. This is operationalized by bonuses that are paid to clinicians by the purchasers of healthcare, who adhere to a number of quality measures and safety practices. One example is the link between diabetes and care. If a physician can achieve high-performance care based on a certain number of quality measures, he or she will be rewarded up to $100 per patient year. In a large panel of patients that might have tens or even hundreds of patients with diabetes, this can be a significant amount of money. An analysis that was done by Bridges to Excellence found that providing this incentive would save employers money because of the higher quality of care that would increase the productivity of their employees. The English Quality and Outcomes Framework is a pay-for-performance program that ties 25% of the pay for general practitioners in England to their performance on 129 quality indicators. The initial assumption was that there would be about 75% achievement, but there actually has been about 97% achievement, which has ended up increasing the cost of the program because the targets for higher quality care were met by most physicians. Another finding is that most of the quality improvement occurred as the program was starting and has since leveled off. Of note is that one of the major unintended consequences of this program has been its excess focus on the electronic health record and all its prompts for quality measures. So does better performance on process measures lead to better outcomes? Yes and no. Patients who choose a top-performing hospital or surgeon, one in the top quartile, have one-half the mortality of those who choose a hospital or surgeon in the lowest quartile. If a patient could make this choice, they would likely experience lower mortality. It has also been shown that participation in the Hospital Quality Alliance by hospitals is associated with lower mortality for myocardial infarction, MI, pneumonia, and congestive heart failure. In addition, it has been shown that adopting the LeapFrog practices are associated with better quality and lower mortality for acute MI. So there are some instances where better performance on quality measures leads to better outcomes. Unfortunately, the story does not end there. There are studies that are negative. One, for example, found that across various quality process measures, hospitals could predict only small differences in mortality from myocardial infarction, CHF, and pneumonia. Another study found that the measures for quality of care of congestive heart failure developed by the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association have little relationship to mortality or rehospitalization rates. Perhaps one of the most negative studies showed that hospitals that participated in a particular pay-for-performance quality effort did not result in improved quality of care. The hospitals did not do any better in the quality measures, and of course, none of the patients had better outcomes. Does public reporting have any effect on quality measures? There was a recent systematic review that looked at studies addressing this question and found that there was very little evidence of improved quality of care when the performance of a physician or hospital was publicly reported. Another study, however, did show that public reporting, when combined with pay-for-performance, improved performance and quality measures versus public reporting alone. Finally, another study looked at general internists in the United States and assessed their views on approaches to quality, and found that many supported financial incentives for quality, though they had concerns for public reporting, especially the impact that it would have on the incentive to care for patients who were sicker or had more complex medical conditions. This slide lists some of the challenges, limitations, and ethical issues in quality assessment and improvement. One of these issues is related to measurement, for example, in elderly patients who often have complex comorbidities with multiple diseases present. These may render recommendations and guidelines, which sometimes work their way into performance measures, as inappropriate. The UK pay-for-performance system, for example, allows exclusions based on various factors. One analysis addressed the issue whether this might result in practitioners trying to game the system by trying to get patients excluded when they should not be, and this was found not to be the case. Another issue is that the care of patients in Medicare tends to be dispersed among many physicians. You may have a primary care physician. Then you may see a specialist affiliated with a different hospital. So it is difficult to attribute quality to a physician or hospital when the patient's care is shared by several practitioners. We also know that new results in clinical trials can render some measures obsolete. Given that we have seen recent changes in recommendations for lowering cholesterol and the treatment of diabetes, if the results from a clinical trial do not support the recommendations of current quality measures, then these measures can become obsolete. Robert Wachter, a well-known writer and quality expert, gives the somewhat funny, though concerning, example of patients who come into his hospital at the University of California, San Francisco, with congestive heart failure and get treated with antibiotics inappropriately. Why do they get treated with antibiotics when they come in with congestive heart failure? When an acutely ill patient presents at the hospital, a clinician will first apply diagnostic efforts to determine whether the patient has pneumonia. Congestive heart failure is not always clear, and the clinician may choose to observe the patient. However, some physicians may prescribe antibiotics to be sure that they meet the quality measure, only to discover later that the patient has congestive heart failure. Finally, with regards to this relatively new and evolving field, it is clear that we need standardized approaches to reporting and measurement. One author has suggested using an approach similar to the standards enumerated by the GAAP principles of accounting. There are also challenges for certain practice environments. Some of the measures have been configured, for example, such that the small numbers of patients in smaller hospitals can inflate performance relative to large hospitals. Measures need to be adjusted for different settings. It has also been shown that safety net hospitals typically have lower quality. However, these facilities that take care of patients who are poor or otherwise disadvantaged from a socioeconomic perspective provide a vital public function. They are, after all, safety net hospitals, where people can go for care when they may not have other options. In fact, the mission of these institutions could be adversely affected if tied into pay for performance, and this measure may actually worsen some of the healthcare disparities that these institutions are set up to address. Finally, we have challenges in small medical practices. These practices have limited time, multiple payers, and relatively small amounts of money for capital investment. One physician notes, "Is it becoming overly burdensome for some of these practices, particularly where he practices in Massachusetts, to be overwhelmed by all of these different quality measurements and other aspects of computerization of their practices?" There are also some ethical issues that we will discuss here briefly. Further exploration of the papers listed on this slide is highly recommended for those seeking a deeper understanding of ethical issues. One issue concerns patient consent. When someone takes part in a research project, there is a process of protection for human subjects. This issue came to the fore when a research project looking at the implementation of quality measures had not been properly vetted by the Institutional Review Board or the Human Subjects Committee to determine whether or not the research protocols were ethical. So a decision needs to be made on whether to treat quality interventions as part of patient care or as research. Lynn, Snyder, and Miller explore this issue and tend to advocate that it be viewed as part of care. There is also the issue of who pays for preventable complications. It is advocated that the patient not be responsible. Of course, the challenge is the identification of truly preventable complications. It is obvious that an object left in a patient is a preventable complication, and most would agree that the organization should be penalized in some way. Other complications, however, are less obvious. When a patient gets pneumonia on a ventilator, is it because the patient was insufficiently suctioned, or improperly moved, or not put into isolation? It is less clear that that is truly a preventable complication, and the question of whether it should be paid for is a little murkier. There are also tensions with regards to quality issues. For example, customers and purchasers may have different priorities when it comes to quality measurement. Customers may want to see everything and have everything focused on their improved care. Purchasers may be more focused on the economic aspects. There is also tension between the desire to improve care and not always having knowledge of the best ways to accomplish this. There may also be tensions between a physician's internal motivations for their patients and pay-for-performance initiatives. One study fortunately found that the internal motivations of physicians were not adversely impacted in a pay-for-performance situation. Finally, how can we achieve a high-performance healthcare system? This was addressed in a recent report by the Commonwealth Fund, an organization that has been measuring the quality problems in healthcare. They advocate that the high-performance healthcare system be guided by certain principles, detailed in their report and summarized on this slide. All patients should have access to care and information, but they should also be held accountable for that information and making appropriate decisions. The healthcare system must then provide coordination of care and take on this notion of continuous learning and improvement. Policy recommendations include reform of the payment system, which of course is probably a solution for all aspects of improving healthcare incentives. They also recommend providing incentives to patients to stay as healthy as possible and to use the healthcare system prudently. Others address regulatory changes that enable high-performance healthcare to be delivered, training healthcare providers in just what we mean by high-performance healthcare and how they can contribute, and having the government provide infrastructure support for some of the things that the private healthcare system cannot provide by itself. Finally, they recommend the use of health information technology as part of the solution to achieving a high-performance healthcare system.